Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, May 6, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, opening a hearing on a public hearing on House Bill 2960 relating to retirement investments. Mr. Warden.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. Before the subcommittee is House Bill 2960A related to retirement investments. Out on OLIS is a draft budget report for the committee's consideration, as well as a dash A9 amendment. The measure has an emergency clause as an effective on passage. However, it is not anticipated that there will be any expenditures during the 2013-15 biennium or the current biennium. The measure creates a 7-member Oregon Retirement Savings Board within the state treasury. The board is directed to develop and implement a defined contribution retirement plan that can be accessed through employee payroll. The board's plan may only be established if the plan does not qualify for employee benefit plans under federal law. Employers must offer the plan unless they provide a qualified retirement plan. Pre-tax contributions to the plan, which would be made by employees only, would begin on July 1st, 2017. The board is required to establish rules for employees to automatically enroll or to opt out of the plan, contributions and withdrawal processes, and exemptions for employers that provide alternative plans. Employee accounts would be held in trust by private third-party investment administrators. Employers in the state of Oregon would have no proprietary interest in the accounts. The measure establishes the Retirement Savings Plan Administrator Fund, into which application, account, or administrative fees or other sources of funding would be deposited. Revenue is anticipated to begin during the 2017-19 biennium after the board establishes fee amounts. A general fund appropriation is required to fund the board's operating expenses until the fund has sufficient revenue to support the activities of the board. The measure stipulates that general fund expenditures are to be repaid with future administrative fees. The measure, as amended, would appropriate $743,541 of general fund and provide for 1.50 FTE to fund the board's operating expenses for the 15-17 biennium, including the requirement of the measure to conduct a market analysis and obtain legal advice. The measure provides an additional $250,000 of general fund for state agencies to assist with outreach and technical assistance activities. These agencies may require additional other funds expenditure limitation once the costs of such activities are known, which will be at the earliest, or which may be on or before January 1st, 2016. Other agencies, such as the Department of Administrative Services, may have a budgetary impact due to the need to establish a process to withhold and transfer contributions for participating temporary state employees who are not eligible for the state's retirement plan. The 2017-19 cost of the measure is estimated to be $326,956, 1.50 FTE. This cost is assumed to be a general fund obligation unless sufficient fee revenue is received from private third-party administrators. And that's the conclusion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have some esteemed guests here to start. Mr. Treasurer, Representative Reed, Senator Beyer, do you have a preferred order about who's going to start? Senator Beyer, Representative Reed, please join us. Thank you, and thank you also for your patience this afternoon.
Thank you, co-chairs, members. For the record, Lee Beyer, state senator from Lane and Linn counties. What you have before you is the result of a task force that you established in the last legislative session funded that was chaired by Treasurer Wheeler, and he can go into some of that. They met extensively over the last year, exploring the problem that we laid out last year when we asked for the task force. And that problem was the fact that if you look at Oregonians, you find that most, nearly one-third, have far less than what's needed to support them in retirement, in savings. Most Oregonians have less than $25,000 in any form of savings account. And this problem, if you think ahead 30 or 40 years particularly, is going to become acute and will be a big, if we don't solve it in some way, will become an incredible large problem for future legislators. The reality is that many of us, or at least those who are close to my age, grew up in an era where you didn't really think about this. There were mostly, most all employers had defined benefit programs, pension plans referred to at that time, and their employers, and they contributed to them, and when they retired, there was a stream of money that matched up with Social Security. Well, over the last 20 years, most of those defined benefit plans, should say most, we know of one that didn't go away completely, have gone away, and you, if you have any at all, you have defined benefit program, or excuse me, defined contribution plan. Although most don't, particularly in the small business sector, there's not there. What we also know empirically is that young people predominantly do not contribute to any type of savings program. But we also know that if they're offered one through their employer, that better than 70% of them take advantage of that. So that's what we're kind of talking about, is we're trying to get at that long-term problem that won't become a drain on the state treasury. So what you have in front of you is the result of the task force's work and a proposal to establish a state-sponsored retirement plan. I say state-sponsored. It will not be a state-operated plan. The model I would suggest you should have in mind is the Oregon College Savings Plan. In that plan, the state offered through an RFP, selected a private sector vendor who would then provide the service to those who wish to subscribe to the plan. Similarly, that would be the likely, that would be the option that would be available under this program. You'd establish, as you did with the College Savings Board, a retirement board that would then do the RFP and select a vendor. And at that point, that vendor would have the relationship with the employees who chose to enroll. I think it's a good structure. One of the controversial pieces of it is it does, or I guess there were two controversial pieces. One of the controversial pieces is that all employers who do not offer some savings plan on their own would be obligated to obligated to allow their employees to participate in this plan. What that means is that, like they do for many other things, they would have to do a payroll deduction and send that payroll deduction to the vendor who is operating the program. They would have no further relationship. They would not be responsible in a fiduciary way about that. They would only have the responsibility to do that. The other piece is that, it's a controversial piece, is that it is intended to be an opt-out rather than an opt-in program. And the reason it's that way is that, frankly, the empirical evidence is that if you provide the plan and say you can choose to opt out if you wish to, most people won't. We're hoping that inertia will cause particularly young people to start savings. And that's the deal. But the important thing to remember in that, some would see that as onerous, is that they can opt out at any time. They never have to start. And the money will always be their money. It will never be the state's money. It will never be the money of the contractor. It's always theirs. And the only restrictions that would be placed on it are the restrictions that are placed on these type of savings plans by the federal and the state government, mostly the federal government in terms of early takeout. You pay a penalty for that. So that's the nature of the program. In terms of the vetting on this, it's been widely vetted. As I said, it was vetted through the last interim through the Treasurer's Commission. It's had hearings in both the House Policy Committee and in the Senate Policy Committee. It comes to you on the positive support from both of those committees. And is there anything else here that I need to talk about? I guess the only other thing, there is some criticism that we've heard about, why do we need to do this? Because there's a raft of other plans in the private sector that's out there, and that is indeed true. What is also indeed true is that the population group we're trying to get at doesn't avail themselves of that. Largely, the marketplace we're talking about, quite frankly, is not very profitable to the providers that are in the business here of doing this. We've heard that, well, you should let us do it. Well, the demonstrated record is that it's not happening. And I guess, you know, I can go back to when I was selling insurance, you know, and that kind of product. I says, you know, one of the good things, if people really think that they have a better product and can provide a better service to a small business and their employees, I guess the thing that I would say if I were in the sales game still, I would say, what a great service you're providing me, because I can now walk into every small business and say, you're mandated to do this. I can provide you a better product. And from my perspective, from a public policy perspective, if they can, that's a better deal. All I really want to do is get people savings and get that product in front of them so that young people are thinking about it. So in 30 or 40 years, the people who are sitting around this dais aren't trying to figure out how do we take care of the elderly population who didn't provide for themselves. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry, just trying to get the public testimony organized.
No problem. I just
didn't
want to presume.
No, thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. Happy to be here with my co-chief sponsor, Senator Beyer, and I endorse everything he said. I'm glad that we're in front of yet another committee to continue our conversation, recognizing that your charge is to deal with the fiscal issues. I thought it might be helpful to just run through the structure of the bill quickly so that you can understand it even more than you already do. Section 1 deals with the board itself and where it lives and its membership and that sort of thing. Section 2 has to do with the duties of the board, including the establishment and implementation of the plan, the rules for the general administration, and the thorough market and legal analysis to identify the most attractive plan for Oregonians. Section 3 outlines the requirements of the plan, including, as has been mentioned, the automatic enrollment for employees with the option of opting out, using existing employer and public infrastructure to facilitate the contributions and requiring no employer contributions to those employee accounts. These are in the bill in order to establish a plan that's easy for employers, professionally managed, and to allow Oregonians to begin saving through this voluntary plan. Section 4 has to do with the rules that the board must adopt for the plan. They're related to the process around that voluntary enrollment, allowing employees to opt out, allowing an employer to gain an exemption from offering the plan if they offer an alternative plan, and for adopting the rules that ensure that the plan is not an employer-sponsored retirement plan. Section 5 is to do with confidentiality of those accounts. Section 6 sets up the administrative fund that Mr. Borden already talked about dictates its allowed uses. Section 7 has to do with prerequisites before the plan is established, including that market analysis that I already mentioned, obtaining legal advice on whether or not ERISA applies to the plan, and we're confident that it does not, coordinating with other states who are undertaking similar efforts. Section 8 requires reports to the governor and to the legislative committees. Section 9 preempts local governments from enacting their own retirement plans for non-public employees. Section 10 identifies the state agencies who will assist in the outreach, the technical assistance, and compliance services, and requires them to collaborate with each other. Section 11 requires those same state agencies to develop a plan for the provision of those services. Section 12 appropriates money from the general fund to reimburse the agencies who provide those services. Section 13 requires a report to committee on the findings of that market analysis, the legal advice, the strategies that they will that the board would use to minimize the costs, and a draft of the request for proposal, as well as a timeline, overview of those contracts, and recommendations on how to increase financial literacy in the state. Section 14 requires the board to open, if everything else is met by in 2017, and says very explicitly that if the board determines that the plan would trigger ERISA, it cannot go forward. And Section 5 has to do with the timeline relating to the appointments to the board. So this, just to reiterate what Senator Beyer said, this bill is the result of a lot of work from the task force, through two committees on the policy side, and we're we commend it to your votes.
Thank you, Representative Taylor.
Thank you,
and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. Thank you both for coming today. I'm not sure which one of you would like to answer this, but when I first learned about this bill, and of course I commend the idea, it's, we do need to get help get people saving. It's obviously a good idea. The ERISA, that was one of the first thoughts that came to my mind, is that we'd be at risk of triggering that. And you touched on it a little bit briefly, Representative Reed, and I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about what you understand to be the risk and not be the risk. And
yes, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I think it's a good question, and it's one we've spent a lot of time thinking about. There are a number of other states who are undertaking similar efforts in this respect. Perhaps it's an advantage that we're a bit of a follower, and we can take advantage of some of those analyses and work that's been done. So I'd point you to a memo that was distributed by the state of Connecticut. I think it's in OLIS. It was when we were in the policy committees. If not, we can certainly get it to you, which explains pretty well that the structure that we're contemplating here does not constitute an employer-sponsored plan and therefore does not trigger ERISA. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, the bill stipulates pretty clearly that the board must coordinate with other states, must obtain legal advice, and I'll read directly from Section 14, which is on the last page, page 6, line 23. If the board determines that the plan developed by the board under Section 2 of this 2015 Act would qualify as an employee benefit plan under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, that's ERISA, the board may not establish the plan.
Follow up? Okay, I'm going to go ahead. Thank you. That's okay.
Kind of
thank you, Chair.
Here.
Thank you. And so, if under what circumstances would the ERISA be triggered? Would it be before, once the bill, let's say the governor signs the bill, and you start doing it, then would the ERISA be triggered at what point? If that was the worst case scenario, and what's the harm even if that were to happen? I mean, what's the harm to the state if that were to go through?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I think there is a fair bit of time between the passage of the bill and the effectiveness of it and the operation of the plan if we get that far. Mm-hmm. That there would be, I think, considerable work, further analysis, communication with the other states, potential communication with the U.S. Department of Labor. And there is evidence, it's even mentioned in the president's budget, to suggest that there's momentum in the federal government to explicitly allow these kinds of structures, rather than being in the sort of I think we're confident, but there is some degree of uncertainty. That's why mm-hmm. we built in so many safeguards. But I don't think we're ever going to get to the point that we would move forward with a plan without a lot of certainty and reassurance.
Okay, thank you,
Senator Johnson.
I have a bunch of questions, but this exchange just triggered one. You said that we're following along behind other states. What states have these been implemented in? Because going back as far as 2007, I think there is a record that consistently points to legal and tax obstacles. What was the experience in Washington or California?
Senator Johnson, the two states that have implemented so far, the state of California and the state of Illinois, there are 20-some other states that are in the process of looking at it in one way or another. Some have chosen not to move forward. Really gets to what kind of plan you're looking at. One of the likely, I think, outcome that we're talking about here is likely to be an IRA kind of sponsored plan, because that is the most unlikely to run into an ERISA problem. If you try to go to some of the different forms, and I think you might want to address these questions more to Treasurer Wheeler when he's up here. He's the expert in this area and worked on them, but that's been the recommendation. We can go there, and you're not likely to do that. One of the problems with ERISA is that the Department of Labor does not like to opine on these things, and it's sort of a catch-22. You know, you can ask, but they won't answer until they decide that there's a problem. So, but That's why I think you'll see, and the treasurer can talk about it, is that the we're most likely, and the recommendation to go to an IRA, which is not likely to have a problem. The real trick is that there's not going to be a relationship between the employer and the plan.
Another question specifically to you, Senator Barber. When we were talking about this in caucus, if my recollection serves me, you made a point of saying this is a voluntary program. It doesn't, by my read of the bill, sound voluntary at all on the part of employers.
It is not voluntary on the part of employers. It's like Social Security in that regard. They are required to participate. It's voluntary on the part of the employee in terms of they can opt out at any time.
Just a comment, and this is anecdotal, but I don't know whether this third-party vendor will have instruments that have any exposure to market risk at all. So my husband bought a retirement plan for his employees, not sophisticated savers. There was market exposure. When the market had a significant correction, their programs all lost considerable amounts of money. They didn't understand what had happened, and the default assumption was that my husband's company had done something wrong or that somehow someone had pilfered their money. We are going to have an awful lot of unsophisticated savers if this passes and comes to be implemented the way you say it is. What's going to prevent us from not having both the public relations difficulties as well as potentially the financial difficulties that accompany this? The 529 plan got into serious trouble. And I'm just trying to figure out, when you're inviting hardworking Oregonians for good reasons to participate in a program that they may or may not understand, what's the downside? And I guess before you answer that, I would say we sat right in the same room yesterday and heard a lengthy explanation about PERS. And I can only drop back in time to think about how PERS started, well-meaning folks believing that hardworking public employees should have a retirement program, and it's going to be the monster that eats state government. What's the prophylactic against that happening here?
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I think the answer to that is there isn't any completely. I remember not too many years ago when my 401k became a 201k.
Yeah. You were lucky. I got a half a 201k
right now. So that can happen. That is the marketplace. The alternative is to do nothing. And we know what happens if you do nothing.
Follow up, ma'am? Again, in this same room, we heard that the level of participation for state employees in the plan provided by the state now only has a 38% enrollment. Doing nothing. A lot of people don't save right now because they're living paycheck to paycheck because of the stagnation of wages and the lack of jobs. So we've got a 38% participation rate in the program that's available right now. How does this actually effectuate a better outcome? When state employees have the option, only 38% are participating.
Senator, I think what you're talking about is the deferred comp plan from the state, which is a pretty standard option among a lot of employers to have that. Most employers, when they have that in the private side, offer a matching to induce people to go there. That would be a great idea. We're not doing that. This is basically, and that's why the opt-out rather than the opt-in is to try and get people on the track of savings. And we're hoping that inertia works.
Madam Chair, Representative, Senator, I add to that by just going back to the volumes of studies that suggest that what's important here is to make it easy for people. More than 70% of people participate when they have access to a retirement plan through their employer, less than 5% when they have to go out and seek it on their own. This bill is not going to solve every problem. It does not absolve us of continued work. But I think what we're trying to do is make it easier for people to do what's in their own best interest.
Senator Whitsitt, and then Co-Chair Smith, and then I'm going to point out to the committee that we have Treasurer Wheeler.
Yeah, I've got to go back to my committee.
Senator Beyer needs to go to his committee, and then we've got three more panels, and we still need to be out by 2:30. So So I want questions, but I also want to be mindful of the time. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Representative Reed, you quoted the opinion from Connecticut, but Connecticut has not adopted the plan. And actually, a opinion from Connecticut probably doesn't have a great deal of a sway over the federal government. It's my understanding the determination of the legality under ERISA would come from the Department of Labor, which has chosen so far apparently not to opine. So, frankly, I don't see any way this doesn't come under ERISA. So, I mean, why are we going forward with the plan until we know? Has the state of Oregon actually queried the Department of Labor to determine whether this falls under ERISA or not? If not, why not? And if they have, why have they not got a response?
Madam Chair, Senator, I will let the Treasurer talk about, I think, some more of the relationship and communications with the Department of Labor. But my understanding is, as Senator Beyer has said, that the Department of Labor generally does not respond to hypotheticals. So we're in that sort of gray area where we can do our best to guess, and that's why I pointed to the state of Connecticut, who has done some analysis. But we would, if the bill passes and is implemented, we would seek our own counsel and do our own analysis and do all that we can to get closer to those answers. But I don't think we're going to have a definitive answer unless the federal government acted on their own. Or until there is a plan for the Department of Labor to react to.
Follow up, would the Department of Labor then respond to a query after this bill was passed or after it was implemented?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I appreciate your confidence in my ability to speak for the U.S. Department of Labor. I don't know.
Well, it was a rhetorical question.
Okay.
There's a couple other things. On page 3, line 10, sub G, whenever possible, use existing employer and public infrastructure to facilitate contributions to the plan, record keeping, and outreach. The only other agency that I know of that does this is PERS. So do you contemplate blending it with PERS?
Madam Chair, Senator, I want to make sure that I answer this question the right way. I think we're interested in making the process as easy as possible for employers. There is no crossover in terms of the dollars or any liability or expectation that PERS has with the dollars that it administers.
Is there an expectation that PERS might administer this plan?
No.
Okay. The under page 2, line 36F, to evaluate the need for and procure as needed pooled private insurance of the plan, what do you contemplate as to insure the plan?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't this may be past my specific knowledge about insurance in these types of pools, but what we're trying to do with the bill generally is to give the board the authority to make the decisions that it needs to design and administer a smart plan. I'd suggest that may be a question to address the Treasurer as well.
Okay. And one final question. This is mandatory for the employer. How will the employer be reimbursed for their efforts?
Madam Chair, Senator, at this point, the obligation to the employer would be to transmit the contributions made by the employees in the same way that they already do for a number of other withholdings.
So the employer would not be compensated?
Not in this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's good having you here. Thanks, mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming for our committee. I want to ask a few ways and means questions. As I look at the language on page 5 and 6, it talks about implementing outreach to business, and I assume that outreach is going to be through the Secretary of State, Department of Revenue, Employment Department, et cetera. One of the concerns I have is that we're only appropriating $250,000 for this outreach. Do you think that's going to be adequate to reach out to the smallest entrepreneur in Lakeview, Oregon, to let them know about their obligation?
Mr. Co-Chair, that is the number that came from the agencies as we talked with them about what would it take. A lot of these already have that relationship and could piggyback on other efforts, other materials they're sending to them. So they've said yes, that is what they'd be able to do.
So what I would share is I think, committee, we're going to be readdressing that number. I mean, I just don't realistically see how $250,000 is adequately going to reach the business community throughout the state of Oregon on a new program of this magnitude. And so I think we'll end up, committee, having to readdress that in the future. We want to make sure if we're going to do this, we really reach out to folks and provide adequate education and adequate understanding of what this all means.
Mr. Chair, if I can, I think I keep drawing parallels to the Oregon College Savings Plan, and I believe the startup costs for that, which was much more difficult to get out because you didn't have that kind of relationship there, was less than $750,000. All of which was paid back.
I hope I'm wrong on that. Talk to me about enforcement. What steps will we take to enforce the implementation of this with small business owners?
The intent, at least at the start, is an honor system. I would describe it that way.
What comes after the honor system?
You know, if you look at most of the employment laws, Ms. Co-Chairs and Senator Johnson, most people are law-abiding, and they do follow through, particularly in the employment laws. At least it's been my observation is that you have a small minority of problems with that.
So I'm sorry, Mr. Co-Chair, are you finished?
No,
I want to make sure
I still have more questions.
If you don't mind holding, Senator Johnson.
So talk to us about the fees we anticipate needing to charge for folks to utilize the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan. For example, with E-Trade, if I go and I place an order, they charge me $19.95 mm-hmm. per order. Mm-hmm. Will we be having a set of fees in order to implement this? And if the answer is no, which I think if I read in the bill correctly, we're going to take administrative costs out of interest earnings.
Yes.
What will that cost be to the entrepreneur or to the investor in lost future income?
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's a way for me to give you a specific numerical answer at this point, but I think the promise of this plan is by having more people in the plan, we can spread those fixed costs over a much larger number of people. The experiences from other states and even from the 529 College Savings Plan suggest that as more people are involved, those fees get lower and lower. I think we've seen that.
Sure.
So that's what we expect to happen. I don't have a specific number, but I think it will be better for those savers, those investors, to be part of that pool than by going as an individual investor.
Yeah, the one thing I would hope we do is analyze this into the future and see if there is just a standard set fee. We ought to be charging folks for the service that they'll be providing, and maybe it's $9.95 per transaction, whichever that deposit transaction would be. But we want to make sure that we're covering the costs
yes.
mm-hmm. of implementation, and at the same time not taking future interest earnings away that over the power of compounding interest, if I start at 18 years old, could amount to a lot of future money. So.
Mr. Chair, I take your point. I think we certainly want to minimize that. I think their structure is such that those costs would be covered from that source, but minimizing it to the greatest degree possible, and I particularly appreciate your point about starting early.
One last thing I want to point out, and it's in the bill, and so I just want to make sure we get this on the record. I think you folks did a very, very good job pointing out that the business owner will not be liable for providing any form of investment advice.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That is correct. Okay.
That's Mr. Chair, that's particularly important under recent decisions where they're extending more fiduciary responsibility onto employers that are offering plans, which I think we could, you know, I'm fearful that we could see a lot of employers bailing because of that, particularly small ones, which is just, there's a lot of information out there that suggests that small employers don't see themselves in a position where wanting to do this is not their business of doing this.
The one thing I would encourage, and then I'll be done with my comments, is I would hope that we'd be able to enter into future partnerships with those folks who help with accounting and bookkeeping services for small business. I'm not too worried about the larger companies. You've got companies out there like QuickBooks and TurboTax, et cetera, and I think there'd be a great opportunity for us to partner with them to help in the education of entrepreneurs and how to implement this correctly. Mm-hmm. I just want to get that on record.
I've got Senator Johnson. Okay. Senator Whitsitt, I really do want to point out I still have the treasurer waiting and a bunch of people.
Very quickly, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
To follow on Co-Chair Smith's question on enforcement, in the private sector, all of the withholdings that I can think of are cross-checked in one manner or another. UIW, Workman's Comp, all these things are cross-checked from between agencies. This would appear to require withholding, and the money would go to a fiduciary. What would keep these employers from just keeping the money? And how would you find out, and how would you track it?
There are some laws, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think they call that stealing.
Yes, sir.
I think the hammer on that is, do they really want to go to jail?
How would you track it? That's the point.
I suspect the employer, there's usually, if you look at a good comparison, would be the plan that the state offers, the deferred comp plan. The employees get monthly statements on that. They get them electronically, I believe, on that. And most people follow that. And if they've seen big zeros, I suspect they would start raising some questions about it.
In addition to that, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, Section 10 and Section 11 have to do with a compliance network of the agencies that are listed there who will be working to provide that compliance service.
That brings us back to Co-Chair Smith's question about the fiscal. And one other thing, I looked at this pretty closely, and I don't see any cap on the administrative cost of this plan. None.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think that is the charge of the board, and it's very clear that we want to minimize administrative fees. I don't know that there's a cap, but it's clear that we have said, I have to find the specific spot, that their charge is to minimize those costs. I'll find that and leave it and point to it in a minute while someone else looks for their question.
Senator Johnson.
The enforcement piece of this still, I understand you don't steal the money, but it seems like now it's going to be a complaint-driven. You've got a multiplicity of agencies that are part of the enforcement network. I know from the constituent work that I deal with that they're befuddled enough now having to call around through multiple state agencies. Who eventually is the adjudicatory authority if someone thinks they have been aggrieved?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that would go through the normal court proceedings. Someone would be able to allege that misconduct.
But there are fiscal ramifications to going into court to allege misconduct, and we're trying to help the poorest savers save. They're not going to have adequate resources to ask for a court adjudication.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think it's unlikely that very many people are going to set out to do that. And if that's the case, then that's a worthy effort in court.
Okay, we're going to need to keep moving. Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time. Here's the plan, folks. Mr. Treasurer, you're going to come up. You've got the time you need. Everybody else, I'm going to warn you, we're going to have to limit testimony to a short period of time, and I apologize. I'll encourage everybody to submit written testimony that will be available on the record. Life happens. I apologize. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, while they're getting settled, the fact that we're limiting testimony on a bill of this magnitude to an hour and a half really is offensive to me. We've been criticized, this legislature has, for these short periods of time to have public conversation about complex issues, and we're replicating that right here.
So Senator Johnson, I appreciate your concern. I would point out that, as Senator Beyer and Representative Reed said, this bill has had substantive hearings in policy committees in both chambers. There were duplicate bills in the House and the Senate, is my understanding, that both had public hearings with substantial public testimony, and my understanding is that's all available in the record for the bill itself. If I'm wrong about that, I hope somebody will correct me, but that's my understanding, is that there have been public hearings in policy committees in both chambers on this. And so I appreciate your concern, but I don't think we're limiting it any more than we normally do in a ways and means thing. I appreciate
it. Well, I just want to note for the record, I'm still pretty vague about the continuing general fund obligation. And you will recall we had a lengthy gloom and doom conversation in our caucus yesterday about the cliff we're going to fall off in 17-19 and about starting new programs that have ongoing general fund call. And that's the path we're marching down right now.
Okay. I will hope that the Treasurer will help us start to address that concern. Mr. Treasurer.
Chair Steiner, Hayward, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the Treasurer for the State of Oregon. With me is Kristen Johnson from the State Treasury. I have a statement I'd like to make, and then I'd also like to take the opportunity to answer some of the questions that were deferred to make sure that your time is used to your fullest capacity, if that's acceptable. At the legislature's request, as you well know, I served as the chair of the Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force. It was very clear from the onset, and the statistics both at the state level and the federal level back the reality that we are in fact facing a retirement security crisis. The task force had a primary objective, which was to find out why so many Oregonians aren't saving for their adequate retirement, despite the fact that there are myriads of products available on the private sector, and answer the basic question, how do we change that? The task force was appointed by the governor. It included seven members, including two members of the public at large, two representatives of business, and two representatives of the financial services industry. Presumably, the legislature asked me to chair the task force in my capacity as state treasurer and with my involvement of retirement savings generally in the context of the state retirement savings plan, but also in the context of the 529 plan, which you've heard something about. It also happens that prior to being in elective office, I served as the executive manager of a private sector company with many offices in the state of Oregon that designed and provided retirement plans to private sector clients. We had seven task force meetings. We took verbal and written testimony from anyone who was willing to offer their expertise and their opinion. They were public meetings. We heard from local and national experts on the reasons for and the effects of inadequate retirement savings. Every meeting had the opportunity for anybody who wanted to provide public testimony, either directly or through writing or other means. Additionally, I had several other meetings in addition to the discussions with stakeholders, people who wanted to talk more in depth about the task force and its directions. I maintained a firm open door policy, which meant additional meetings, emails, and phone calls to supplement the information that we learned through the task force meetings. In addition, I directed my staff to meet specifically with organizations and individuals who are known to be in opposition to this proposal to hear their objections and potentially strengthen the recommendations to the legislative body. All of this communication informed the task force report and its recommendations. The recommendations underwent several revisions in order to achieve what ultimately was near unanimous approval. Although we did not have complete agreement on the role of the state, many of the state's suggestions made by the one dissenting member of the task force did make it into the recommendations, and there was unanimous agreement on many of the plan components, including on the question of automatic enrollment. After the task force submitted its report to the legislature, I continued to meet with various people and other stakeholders who were involved with the task force efforts. And I also set up meetings and town halls with financial service providers, small business owners and operators, chambers of commerce, and individuals taking me across the state. This outreach, combined with the work of the task force, led to House Bill 2960. From the beginning, I didn't want the task force to report to become one more report that sits on a shelf and becomes a colossal waste of everybody's time, energy, and financial resources. The legislature asked for recommendations to address a crisis so that you could take action this session. To this end, we focused on providing recommendations that flowed from our findings and which could be successfully implemented. Arguably, our most important finding was that we have an access issue. When a retirement plan is offered through a place of employment, people are 15 times more likely to participate in that plan. For better or worse, people expect to receive their benefits through their place of employment. In my many conversations with small business owners and operators, most would like to offer their employees a plan, even if they don't currently. That's backed by the facts. Many view their employees as family. The reality is that administrative costs, legal liability, and an abundance of complex options make it very difficult for small employers to be able to provide plans. House Bill 2960A overcomes these specific issues. Under House Bill 2960, there is minimal cost to employers. What they'll be responsible for is two things. First of all, handing out a packet to their employees. And second of all, as you heard Representative Reed testify, they will be required to do an automatic payroll deduction the same way they do today for FICA and other payroll deductions. There is no employer liability under ERISA, and employers are not responsible for the ongoing maintenance of the account. Instead, the financial relationship is between the employee and the plan provider. That plan would be provided by the private sector utilizing existing financial products. In my mind, that's an IRA, and I'll talk about that when I answer the question about ERISA. The plan is portable, and it will follow the employee from employer to employer. It will follow the employee from employment into unemployment. The benefit of state sponsorship is the ability to pool these accounts that could not otherwise be brought together, and negotiating and overseeing the contract to service these accounts ensure low administrative fees and high returns as possible. Since we've based the structure on the Oregon 529 College Savings Plan, we know that the bureaucratic footprint will be minimal. There's an additional benefit. This plan will help us reach those who are not today saving through their place of employment for their own retirement. In other words, this will reach people who are currently nobody's clients. You're going to hear about other options today. Some have called for an increase in financial literacy. I want you to know I strongly support that. One caveat, the task force heard compelling information that while financial literacy programs are really important, they are not in and of themselves sufficient to overcome the obstacles or the structural barriers to saving for retirement. However, the board created by House Bill 2960 will recommend a plan to ensure our financial literacy efforts improve. That's called for in Section 13. Some have called for us to do more to encourage businesses to offer a 401k or another premium plan. Once again, I strongly agree with that recommendation. We should encourage businesses to offer more sophisticated options than that is suggested under House Bill 2960. With that in mind, the board is expressly charged with developing an outreach plan to that effect. That's in Section 21G. And the board will be in a position to recommend additional measures such as tax credits as it gains more information. Some have suggested that we create an online exchange so that businesses will see through a one-stop shop what options are available. Let's just say I do not support the state creating an online exchange for this purpose, but there are people in this room behind me who already have the ability and the capacity to create this through private sector means, and I'm offering myself again to be helpful and instrumental in that effort if I can be. Nearly half the states in the country are now considering proposals or studying or established state-sponsored retirement plans for state-sponsored workers. As you heard, Illinois and California have now enacted laws to offer state-sponsored IRAs. They know, like we know, that we can't wait for Washington, D.C. to act. The financial stakes for the state of Oregon are too high. In summary, we're offering a solution to reach people who are hard to reach, who are not currently saving, who are nobody's clients. We're going to do it by making it available at the place of business where people are 15 times more likely to save. We're going to use an auto-enroll mechanism. And although you cannot see this, the top line shows that through automatic enrollment, savings rates are very high and participation is close to 100% after a three-month period. And we're also going to pool the resources to keep the costs low and have them professionally managed so that people don't have to game the market. They have somebody who's looking specifically at their interests over the long term and investing their resources. A public sector board would be created by the legislation for public accountability and transparency. It will leverage the private sector by using a private sector provider or providers to actually operate the plan, and it will use existing private sector retirement savings products. Finally, the burden and cost on businesses will be negligible. The bottom line is this: if we cannot find ways to encourage those who can save for their own retirement to do so voluntarily, the cost to Oregon taxpayers will be staggering as more and more Oregonians rely instead on costly government safety net programs. I encourage your support for House Bill 2960. At the discretion of the chair, I'm happy to answer some of the questions that were asked around cost, ERISA, and some of the other issues.
I'd appreciate if you'd start addressing those, Mr. Treasurer, since your perspective will be important for
Very
us.
Good. Okay. First of all, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am not an attorney, but I'm sitting next to one, and she will undoubtedly have an opinion on this. First of all, with ERISA, there are legal opinions that currently exist. I would say there are no definitive legal opinions. The definitive legal opinion would come from the Department of Labor. As was mentioned during the testimony, there have been hints. I would refer you to one legal opinion in particular that I think is of interest. It's from David Morse from K&L Gates. He's an ERISA attorney. He's nationally acknowledged as an expert on this issue in the Department of Labor. He provided a lengthy document to state treasurers nationally. In that, he makes the case that an auto-enroll voluntary or with an auto-enroll with an opt-out clause using an IRA product would in fact be exempt from ERISA. The core of that gets to the use of the IRA product. IRA products are already explicitly exempt from ERISA. ERISA basically says the employer cannot endorse the plan. In this case, what you're hearing opponents say is it's a mandate. Well, if it's a mandate, then they're certainly not endorsing it. They are required to provide this packet of information to their employers, and there is no endorsement on the part of employers because their relationship is not with the employee when it comes to the retirement plan. The relationship is between the employee and the private sector provider of the plan. In addition, There's no endorsement. It's voluntary, and it's tax exempt. Co-Chair Smith had asked about what do we estimate the cost to be. The bill did not explicitly state that. It requires the market research that the board is required to conduct to determine how many people would participate. We've seen two studies, one from Portland State that suggested approximately 450. We saw another from AARP that suggested approximately 650,000 participants. What we do know is that with $2 billion in assets under management, the current cost of the 529 college savings plan is about 22 basis points. 17 basis points go to the provider for their administrative overhead. 5 basis points go to the state to cover the administrative overhead. In addition, there is a varying scale of internal fund fees depending upon what people choose to invest in. Higher risk, higher maintenance vehicles will cost more. Lower maintenance, lower risk index funds obviously cost a lot less. But we expect that this plan will have more assets than the college savings plan, meaning presumably our fees would actually be lower. There was a question asked about enforcement from Senator Johnson. There has not been a final enforcement mechanism concluded. That's been left to rulemaking. But I want to support what Senator Whitsitt said in terms of the most cost-effective way to do it. The way to do it, rather than auditing everybody's statements and having a costly and burdensome oversight program, I like the idea of random sampling. That's basically the basis of the IRS process. You will be aware of the fact that there will be random sampling, and if you are caught, my recommendation would be that the fees be stiff by way of setting an example that you need to play by the rules on this plan.
I'm going to ask you a pause for a moment because Co-Chair Smith has a question.
Oh, I didn't want to interrupt.
It's your choice, Mr. Co-Chair.
When the Treasurer is complete, I'll ask
that's fine.
My question.
Thank you.
Finally, there was a question. I'm sorry I didn't write down who had asked it. The question was about who would actually do the enforcement. My understanding is that it is Boley that would conduct that enforcement. And then finally, somebody said, I believe it was Senator Johnson, there was a question of people not having a good knowledge or a good grasp on how best to manage these resources or what options to pick. To that, I would say, let's keep it simple. Fewer options, a simple product like an IRA, and a key component of this bill is that the resources are pooled and professionally managed by an organization that does nothing but manage these resources full time.
If I may, I just want to clarify one thing you said before my co-chair goes ahead. Sections 10 and 11 on page 5, yes, lines 27 through 38, don't really specify, actually. They just talk about this network with the Secretary of State, Department of Revenue, Employment Department, DCBS, Boley, and that's it, and any other agency. Both of those talk about that to provide outreach, technical assistance, and compliance. So my understanding is that the exact mechanism of who would do the enforcement has not yet been determined. If I'm wrong about that, Mr. Treasurer or Ms.
Kristen Johnson, that's correct. We have a lot of work to do before we can even think about accepting contributions. This will be a 2 years out. That's one of the things that's on the list of things that we have to figure out.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is a savings program, not an investment program. As I understand it, have we set a level of expectation as to what the saver will anticipate? Mm-hmm. Are we looking at putting it into an index fund? Talk to us so we know what that level of expectation is for that person walking out there who saves.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Smith, again, there's a question. This will be sent through an RFP process, meaning private sector providers can explore the universe of what they think are the right options for our citizens, and they
Let me interrupt. I don't mean to, but sure. I really want to understand this. I think our committee. Are you anticipating a portfolio of options that the consumer can save into, or are you anticipating it will be one?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that has not been determined, but I will give you my opinion. My opinion is that given the market we're trying to reach, non-savers, we're trying to keep the cost low, we're trying to get people in the habit of saving part of their own paycheck for their own retirement so that taxpayers don't bear that burden. Keeping it simple, I think, is extraordinarily important, and keeping it low cost is extraordinarily important. Therefore, if it were up to me, which it is not, but if it were up to me, I would say limited number of funds and lower cost, easy to understand funds like index funds or lifestyle funds. Or we have a great fund in our college savings plan that's called Principal Plus Interest that protects your savings. To date, and I like that plan, and it's been popular, and I'd like to see something like that included. But it's really up to the board to signal to the private sector what kind of options they'd like to see in the plan. But again, keep it simple, keep it low cost, keep it limited in terms of the number of options would be my recommendation.
And I would support that as well. I do believe Senator Johnson has raised an issue, though, that you know during the good times, I think everyone's going to be patting our state treasurer on the back. And during
really?
Recessionary times, recessionary times, everyone's going to want your neck. Mm-hmm. And
wow.
So I think that's just a reality that we're going to have to acknowledge.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, everybody's wanted my neck since the day I got here, and the market's been on a tear. You basically needed a dart to hit the right target. The fact is this. There is always risk in any savings or any investment vehicle. The one possible exception to that is the principal plus interest issue that we added to the college savings plan. And I want to just say that by way of underscoring a point. We've learned a thing or two. People got hammered in 2008. People who'd saved for years for their kids' college retirement, and their kids were going to go to college in the 2009 school year, and all of a sudden they found out that they had been hit really, really hard by the economic downturn. That's why we added the principal plus interest option. It was a learning lesson. You get a lower rate of return, but it protects your principal. And so people who are closer to retirement are going to want something that protects the savings that they've generated over a period of years. And we need to be smart enough to include that kind of an option.
Ms.
Johnson.
Sir, Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to include to correct a couple things on the record regarding ERISA. So there is no judicial opinion yet on whether or not a plan like this would conflict with ERISA or would trigger ERISA because there is no state-sponsored plan. What we're looking at doing and what other states are looking at doing is offering an IRA. And the reason we wanted an IRA, and we alluded to this earlier, is because it's exempt from ERISA. But it's only exempt from ERISA if it meets four requirements. The first is no contributions are made by the employer, so we made that clear in the legislation. The second is participation is completely voluntary for employees. This is the area where there is a difference of legal opinion. We've gotten legal guidance that has said that this is completely voluntary, having the auto-in rule with an opt-out, but it's something that we need to investigate more, and that's why we are asking for an appropriation for legal guidance. We've also said, though, this happened in the policy committee that we had earlier, and we got clarification on this point, that could be taken out because it's completely severable if we need to remove that piece because it conflicts with ERISA. The third piece is the employer's activities with respect to the IRA are limited to and without endorsement permitting the IRA sponsor to publicize the program to its employees, collecting contributions through payroll deductions and remitting the contributions to the IRA sponsor, which goes back to making it clear that they cannot provide any, they shouldn't be providing any financial advice or endorsement of the plan. The last piece is the employer receives no consideration in the form of cash or otherwise. This is one of the reasons why we didn't specifically have a tax incentive or a tax credit in order to compensate for any amount that the employer would have in terms of administrative costs and admitting the program. What we have said, though, is that the board is supposed to come back and make a recommendation for a tax credit to cover any administrative costs in the future, but it would trigger ERISA if we gave more money than the actual cost of permitting the program.
Sarah Johnson.
I think this is going to be a litigation field day. Teeing off of something the treasurer said about many employers consider their employees family, my husband has had employees for more than 35 years, and I'm trying to imagine the scenario in his office when one of them comes in and says, "What do I pick?" And the answer is, what's the deal with the rate of return? I can't answer that. And then as soon as John says, well, you know, Fred in our office picked X plan, all of a sudden you've given advice. Then there's the quick trip over to Boley. Then there's the heavy-handed enforcement. I just don't see how practically you're going to stay out of the trap of employer advice on any of the instruments, especially when you're dealing in these closely held companies where there are very close interpersonal relationships.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that is a fair concern. and it's already one that exists out there in the private sector savings market today. One of the variables that would be used to judge the different companies that would compete for this business is their ability to provide information to those who are participating in the plan. Ideally, that's a strong function so that the employer can simply say, you know what you should do is you should call Joe, and here's Joe's information. See you later. I agree that there's a temptation to do that. There is already a temptation for people who have 401k plans to go to their employer and ask for financial advice. The fact of the matter is, if you're not licensed to do so, you should not be providing financial advice. One possible outreach opportunity is this plethora of state agencies provide employer handbooks every year. That should obviously be underscored, and part of the public outreach to this program needs to be educating the employer about their minimal role in this program, because it is a minimal role.
I guess my response to you would be, we're anticipating between 450,000 and 600,000. You talking about keeping costs down. If my husband's response to his employees is go call the third party vendor, and 600,000 calls come into the third party vendor, I don't know how you have enough. I mean, the administrative cost will just eat this whole thing up.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, weirdly enough, the facts don't bear that out. In fact, volume providers, I think Co-Chair Smith mentioned Vanguard, they get millions of calls. And so part of the service that they provide is a robust customer service organization that's low cost and responsive. So that's obviously one of the variables that the state should be looking at. And I don't mean to discount what you're saying. I agree with you that that temptation is there, and we need to do everything we can to overcome it.
Maybe the third-party vendors are, but we've sat in these hearing rooms in Ways and Means and heard state agencies say over and over and over again, we need more FTE to handle call volume. The judicial ruling at PERS, request for more people to handle call volume. So I think there are going to be ongoing and significant costs is my deepest concern.
Okay. If there are no further questions for the treasurer, I'm going to say thank you very much to him and to Ms. Johnson and let you go. And thank you for your patience. Committee, we have two choices at this point. I have nine more people, well, 10 more, including Senator Knope, who requested to testify, signed up to testify. I want to give people an opportunity to testify. We do not have time between now and 2:30 to have 10 people testify, no matter how fast anybody goes, and certainly not to give the meaningful testimony and let people ask questions. So even though there have been substantive, in fact, three substantive policy hearings on this, I do think that Senator Johnson's point is well taken. We have two choices. We can push through. I can stay, and I will stay, although I have committee at 3. I can stay till at least 3 and do that, or we can carry this over till tomorrow. Regardless, I'll let Senator Knope testify today, and then we can put everybody else on for tomorrow. I would normally not do that, but virtually everybody who signed up testimony is normally in the building anyway.
Madam Co-Chair, I just received word from leadership that they would like us to continue to press forward.
Okay. I wish our leaderships would talk to each other, because
well, then that guarantees a no from me. I can't stay, and I am well dissatisfied with the impact on the general fund.
And colleagues, what I'd share with you is I'm a soldier, and so I appreciate that message.
I would like us to stand at ease. We're going to stand at ease for a moment. Julie, can you put us at ease for a moment, please? Thank you very much. We're back. Okay, here's the plan, folks. We are going to carry over the public hearing and work session until tomorrow. Tomorrow, everybody who was already signed up on the list may testify. Also for 2 minutes, submit written testimony. That way we'll have time for questions. So the 10 people, which I now have, is DJ Vogt, Betsy Earls, Elizabeth Howe, Tom Simpson, Elise Brown, Jan Meekums, Lee Mercer, John Bartholomew, Linda Brown, and Senator Knope. Can testify tomorrow, and we'll have time for questions, and then we'll deal with it. But my feeling is that way we can actually ask folk questions. People have a chance. It's now they know they have limited time to submit further written testimony, although looking back in the record, many of you have testimony in from previous hearings on this bill. in both chambers. So does that seem reasonable to the committee?
Thank you very much for your accommodation. It's very reasonable.
Okay. Everybody copacetic with this? Okay. I apologize to anybody who traveled. Mr. Mercer, I know you came up for this, and I apologize, but I think it's the only fair way to do this at this point and make sure. So I am carrying over House Bill 2960 for a public hearing and work session to Thursday, May 7th at 1 p.m. With that, we're adjourned. With that, we're adjourned.